Position theory is one of these fields that has emerged from mathematical physics, all trying to describe phase transitions. And often these models are very simplistic, but they have an amazingly rich phenomenon. So this project here was an attempt to somehow unite the two worlds. And of course I should explain what this phrase scale-free percolation means, because I mean it has a meaning. So bear with me for a little bit. So these are the kind of slides that we've already seen yesterday. Networks, highly variable degree distributions, scale-free behavior, and small world properties for them. And that's again my starting point, but now I want to take it a little bit differently. So let's recall what the setup was yesterday. So we have lots of random graph models, and typically what they do is they take some sort of a vertex set, often finite, and then they create a random graph by putting in random choices for the edges between them. And you can do that in several different ways. Of course, with a beautiful Erdős-Renyi model where everything is IID, but you can also do that in an homogeneous way, or you can fix the degree sequences, or you can even do it in a dynamic way where the random graph grows as time progresses. So that's sort of the setting where we were yesterday. But now let me come clean with you, because one of the problems that these models have is that they have very little clustering. It's very unlikely to have triangles. Of course, you will have them. For example, in the sparse Erdős-Renyi random graph, you will have a Poisson number of triangles. But you're not going to have any K4s, for example. And you know, when we think of these models as trying to model something real, a real network, let's say a social network or so, what you tend to see is that there's lots of triangles and even complete graphs of size 4 or 5 or 6 or whatever. There are lots of them. So you have lots of clustering. These graphs tend not to be trees. Okay? So we need a different concept in order to model that in, and there are tons of ways how you do that. But now let me come to the spatial aspect. So if you look at random graphs, often the spatial aspect of the network that we're dealing with is being forgotten about. And of course, you can think of space as describing the location of where the individuals in your social network are, let's say, on the planet. But you can also think about this a little bit more abstractly and think about somehow the individuals in your network having attributes. And somehow individuals with attributes that are somehow close to one another are more likely to get to know one another than people who have attributes that are very far away from each other. So this could either be a sort of geometric space, but you could also say, you know, we're all mathematicians, and mathematicians are more likely to know one another even when they're on different places in the planet. Right, so maybe we all want to have somehow an indicator that describes how mathematical we are, and when two people have somehow a field that is very close, then also they are more likely to know one another. So that sort of steps away from the two-dimensional picture on the face of the Earth to a higher dimensional space that I don't really have an understanding of what it could be, but it sort of puts it into a general geometric context. Now the good thing about this geometrical context is that what you tend to have is that things that are close by one another, they're more likely to have edges between them. So if I have a couple of vertices that are pretty close by one another, it's actually not unlikely that they're all connected to one another. So I get, you know, complete graphs of size 4, 5, 6 for free. Right? So you can think of this geometry as being intimately related to the amount of clustering that is there in your graph. That's sort of the perspective that I would like to explore in the coming talk. Now, a little bit more about what we've done yesterday. So we've looked at this configuration model in quite some detail. I discussed a little bit what the preferential attachment model is, this dynamic way of visualizing the growth in networks. I didn't say very much about inhomogeneous random graphs. Of course, Joel has told us all about the Erdős-Renyi random graph, which is completely homogeneous. But you should think of inhomogeneous random graphs as somehow being inhomogeneous versions of the Erdős-Renyi random graph, where somehow some vertices are more likely to get to know other people than other vertices. And one way of doing that is just associating a vertex weight to every vertex, and vertices with very high weight, they are more likely to attract edges than vertices with a very small weight, and therefore somehow the inhomogeneity is built into the model. And there's very deep and intimate relations between these inhomogeneous random graphs and the configuration model, for example. Okay, well, I'll be a bit more concrete about what an inhomogeneous random graph is now. So this is a very particular example of an inhomogeneous random graph. It's sometimes called the Norris-Reitu model, but it certainly fits into the general class of inhomogeneous random graphs as they were described by Bolobas, Janssen, and Reardon in a sort of a seminal paper from 2007, 120 pages, where they studied all sorts of different properties of such inhomogeneous random graphs, sort of in rather great generality. Okay, so the whole point about an inhomogeneous random graph is that what you try to keep from the Erdős-Rényi random graph is that edges are independent, but what you move away from is that all the vertices are the same. Okay, so edges are still independent, but edge probabilities may be different for different pairs of vertices. Okay, now one way of doing that is by associating weights to the vertices, and you can either make them deterministic, or think about them as being deterministic, or you can let them be IID. In fact, in many cases, it doesn't really matter a great deal as to how you pick it, so let's just stick to the setting of IID random variables. So we have IID weights along the vertices, and the picture you should have in mind, the mental picture, is that vertices that happen to have a very large weight, these are the individuals in your social network that are extremely active, and therefore they tend to know lots of people, whereas sort of the wallflowers will have a weight that is very small, and they get to know very little people. Okay? And then how do we build that into the model? Well, we make the edges to be independent conditionally on the weights. Now, these weights are random, of course. And we make the edge probability between I and J 1 minus e to the power minus lambda wi wj over n, in this case, where n is the number of vertices. Okay? Well, what is the idea behind this? Well, for many cases, you know, when the weights are not humongously large, then actually you can approximate 1 minus e to the power minus x, basically by x. And then what you see is that this has a product structure. The probability of having an edge between I and j is roughly the weight of I times the weight of j, properly renormalized by n and multiplied by lambda, just to make it a bit more general. All right. So that's the picture we have. Now, of course, if you make that approximation, 1 minus e to the power minus x is roughly x, then it looks a lot like another model that has been studied a lot in the combinatorics community. This is sometimes called the Chung-Liu model, or the random graph model with prescribed expected degrees. Now, the reason for that is that if I think about these wi's here, well, the weight of the degree of a vertex with a given weight will be very close to a linear multiple of that weight. Now, sometimes it's set up in such a way that it's precisely this weight, and then instead of dividing through by n, you would have to divide through by the sum of all the weights. That is something that you can do as well, and is a very common thing to do. So these are related models that have been studied as well. And there's a beautiful paper by Janssen, Svante Janssen, in 2010, that actually investigates when these models are what he calls asymptotically equivalent. Asymptotically equivalent basically means that, you know, the probability of any event under the two different models will converge to the same thing, or the difference will converge to zero. Okay? All right. Now, again, these models, certainly when these weights are not too extremely large, these models are again of the form that you maybe have a highly variable amount of edges per vertex, but again, having triangles is relatively rare. So you don't have a lot of clustering. All right. Now, on the other extreme, there is a model which is well known out of the percolation community. So there we step away from finite graphs. We look at infinite graphs, the infinite lattice. Now, that has a big advantage, at least in a mathematical physics term. So today we've already heard from Joel that if you look at the Erdős-Rényi random graph, which you can also think of as being percolation on the complete graph, there is not a unique phase transition. The phase transition is being smeared out. And that's immediately due to the fact that the graph is finite. And on a finite graph, you cannot have singularities of anything. You know, any probability is just a finite polynomial, and therefore it has to be continuous and differentiable, etc., etc. And what you see is that you approach a singularity as the network size tends to infinity. And that's actually the emergence of the giant component. So the phase transition is being smeared out. Well, on the other hand, if you look at percolation models, where you're on ZD, well, now things are no longer finite polynomials, so you can actually have phase transitions, and things can be singular. Okay? So there's a whole branch of mathematics that studies these kind of problems. And the kind of model that I would like to think about here is what is sometimes called long-range percolation. So in long-range percolation, so we've already in Rick's talk seen nearest neighbor percolation, and in nearest neighbor percolation you're only looking on, let's say, the square lattice, ZD, or the hypercubic lattice, and you're deciding for each of the edges whether you keep them or not. So now we're not doing this on the square lattice, but we actually do it on the full product space, ZD times ZD. So you could actually be connected to anything, but the probabilities for that will become very small. Right? So you have a sizable probability of being connected to your direct neighbor. You still have a sizable probability of being connected to a person, let's say, 10 Euclidean distance 10 away, but you're much less likely to be connected to a vertex that has Euclidean distance 1,000 away. It's possible, but it's quite unlikely. Okay? So this is called long-range percolation because actually, you know, any edge is allowed, and sort of if I look on the entire lattice, I will see edges of an arbitrary length. They're just going to be very sparse. Okay? Now, what people are typically interested in percolation problems is there a giant component or not? Now, because we are dealing with an infinite lattice, what typically is the case is that there is a parameter, and if you keep more edges than described by that parameter, then actually you will have a giant component, and often that giant component is unique, and that giant component is an infinite component. And it's sort of the analogon to the giant component that we've seen in Joel's talk, which contains a positive proportion of the vertices. But here it's really infinite, because we're on an infinite lattice. Okay? Now, the thing about this model is that you can explicitly write down what the degree distribution is in your graph. So what is the degree distribution? Well, that's just the number of edges incident to a certain vertex, let's say the origin. Well, all of these edges are there independently of one another. So it's just a sum of indicator variables. Now, you can do everything with that. You can compute the mean, you can compute the variance, etc., etc. Yeah? So the degree distribution is very well defined. All right. Now, what are sort of the properties that are being investigated? Well, percolation function. Of course, we know that there's going to be a critical value in many of these cases. And then the question is this percolation function continuous? Well, it's going to be zero for a small parameter, and then it's going to become positive after some critical value. So the only discontinuity that you can have is at the critical value. Now, in nearest neighbor percolation, this is sometimes called the holy grail of percolation theory. In some dimensions, we know that the percolation function is continuous, but in many dimensions, we do not know that. So in three dimensions, nearest neighbor percolation, we do not know that the percolation function is continuous. Well, the physicists do know this, but they don't have a mathematical proof.
Well, could you say again the percolation function? I missed that.
Okay, yes. Good point. So suppose I have a parameter, and in this case, the parameter of interest is this lambda. Okay. I can look at, first of all, x is connected to y when there is an occupied path from x to y. Okay. Then, for an x, I can write down what the cluster is of x. That's the set of y for which x is connected to y. Bear in mind, this actually depends on the configuration, and the law of the configuration depends on this parameter lambda. Okay. And then I can define theta of lambda, and that's the smallest value for which theta of lambda is strictly positive. Okay? Sorry, that's not good. The probability lambda that C of 0 or any x its translation invariant is infinity. So there is paths of infinite length coming out of the origin is strictly positive. Well, this is lambda C. And theta of lambda is just the probability that. You have an infinite component, right? And this is the function that typically ought to have singularities. Okay? So this function will be zero up to a point, and then it will become positive after that point. You don't know precisely what happens at that unique critical point, at that lambda C, but it cannot be analytic, because it's zero on a certain domain and becomes positive somewhere else, so there has to be singularities. Now the question is, what is the order of the singularity there? So it's believed that it's a second order phase transition, that means that the function is continuous, but the derivative is not. But it's not known. It could be a first order phase transition. All right. So that is what is being investigated. But certainly in this long range setting, you can investigate many more questions. For example, how do graph distances behave? Suppose I'm in a supercritical setting. There is this infinite component. I take two vertices that are pretty far apart from each other. I condition them both being in the giant component that will occur with strictly positive probability. How long is the path? How many hops are there between these two vertices in the giant component? That's very much related to the graph distances that I was talking about yesterday. Okay? All right. Now, this model is good in the clustering sense because, you know, I have a sizable probability to be connected to a neighbor, sizable probability to be connected to another neighbor, and they have a sizable probability of being connected to one another, so it's quite likely to see triangles in this graph. That, of course, is not true in the nearest neighbor model, but in this long-range model it is. Okay? So these are the good facts. That's why I have colored them green. Now, the bad thing is that this model can never be scale-free. Well, why not? Well, the scale-free nature of graphs is related to somehow the moments of the degree variable. And I've already written down what this degree variable is here. Right, so I can explicitly compute what its expectation is. So I take the expected value of the degree of x. Well, it's a sum of independent random variables. It's going to be the sum over y of the expected value of this indicator, and that's just the probability that that indicator is equal to 1, which is pxy, and that's some number. And this is actually going to be finite when alpha is strictly larger than d. And that's actually the setting that I would like to look at, because if alpha is strictly larger than d, then the expectation is infinite, and it's a sum of I d indicators, therefore the thing will be infinite almost surely. That's not very interesting. Then actually everybody has infinitely many neighbors. Okay? So that's the setting that I would like to look at. Okay? So this is the mean. So in a certain sense, this corresponds to the setting that we're in, that the graph is sparse. Right? In sparse random graphs, the average degree is finite as well, uniformly in the size of the graph. And we see something similar here. So let's now look instead at the variance of this random variable. Well, now it comes in very handy that these indicators are independent. So the variance of a sum is the sum of the variances. But the variance of a Bernoulli variable is p times 1 minus p. Yeah? Now, p times 1 minus p is always less than or equal to p. Well, that's the mean. Right? So in this setting, it's completely impossible to have finite mean degrees, but infinite variance degrees. Variance is always less than the mean. Now, in many of the scale-free settings that I was talking about yesterday, you see these power laws where the tail decays of the probability mass function decays like some exponent where the exponent is in between 2 and 3. Then you have finite mean, but infinite variance. That's just impossible here. Cannot happen. Okay? Now there's another thing that actually cannot happen in such models, and that's an effect which is called instantaneous percolation. So I'm looking at what happens when this parameter changes, right? Now, it could be the case, not impossible, that if lambda is zero, then of course the whole graph is completely disconnected. I have no edges whatsoever. But if I make it a little bit positive, then immediately I have an infinite component. That's sometimes called instantaneous percolation. That turns out not to occur here. It's just impossible. Well, of course it does occur when alpha is larger than when alpha is smaller than d. But that's a case that I don't find very interesting, because then my degrees are all infinity. In the other cases, it doesn't occur. Okay? All right. So these are the two different kind of models that I would like to find an interpolation between, that actually has all the good features that we see in both the models. That's what scale-free percolation is aiming for. And scale-free percolation is nothing but percolation in a random environment. And for a mathematical physicist, this may sound very, very weird, because, you know, percolation is always the random environment in which we do things. And I think this is one of the reasons why this model has never been invented in the mathematical physics community, because it's sort of strange to create a random environment that has a random environment of its own. Okay? But I will hope to show you today that this is actually an interesting perspective. So what is the model? So again, we work on ZD in the spatial percolation setting. And now what we do is we equip every vertex, like in the inhomogeneous random graph, with a random weight. And now I'm on the infinite lattice, so I'm just going to assume that all of these random weights are IID. Okay? And now I build something that is right in between the inhomogeneous random graph and long-range percolation, in the sense that I keep this product of the weights, but I also keep the dependence. This product of the weight is present in the inhomogeneous random graph, but I also build in this decay depending on the spatial distance that is present in long-range percolation. So I have a bit of both. Now you really have competing effects, because, well, in long-range percolation, if I take two vertices that are extremely far away, they are not likely to be connected. But here they might still be connected, because they might have a weight that is extremely large. And somehow when these weights become extremely large, it's like it shrinks the distance. Okay? So you might have more variability because of the variability that is present in these weights. That's the idea. And we will be aiming for power laws, and therefore in that setting we will be interested in cases where these weight variables actually obey a power law themselves. So the asymptotic tail of these weights actually decreases to zero relatively slowly as a power of the size. If you don't know what a slowly varying function is, just ignore it. Just think of this as decaying to zero at infinity, like an inverse power of W. Okay? So what we see here is that the long-range nature that we also see in long-range percolation, that is actually determined by this parameter alpha. If alpha is extremely large, then the long-range nature will be less pronounced. If alpha is very small, then it will be more pronounced. The percolative properties are determined by this extra parameter lambda. And the inhomogeneity, which is novel in this long-range percolation setting, is determined by the distribution of these W-axes and the fact that they are IID. Right? Now, if you look at this model very closely, you might object to the precise setting, and you would have a very valid point. Because I'm over-parameterizing things. I mean, why put in a lambda if my W actually has a general distribution? I might as well have put it into the W itself. Well, there's a point here. And the point is that I would like to think of my lambda as being the varying parameter, keeping the W's fixed. And of course, if you put the lambda into the W, you cannot do that. Right? I really want to think of the lambda as being the percolation parameter, and I would like to investigate for a fixed choice of the distribution of my weights, for which lambdas I will have an infinite component and for which lambdas I will not. Right? So indeed there are some hidden extra, there's too many parameters here, but this is on purpose. So bear with me. Is the formulation of the model clear? Right? Of course, I haven't explained yet why this is called scale-free percolation. But let me just write down the model so that you will remember. We have that the w-axis for x and z d are iid. The edges are there independently, conditionally on the weights. So if you give me the weights, then all the edges are independent. But of course, they're not going to be independent if I vary the weights. There is some dependence. So the probability that the edge x, y is there, conditionally on the weights, is going to be 1 minus e to the power minus lambda wx, wy over x minus y, Euclidean distance to the power alpha. And what I'll be particularly interested in is the setting where the weight of a variable decays like an inverse power of W. Okay? So I'll just write these down here so that you don't, so that you won't forget. All right. So that's our setting. Okay, now what will we be interested in? Well, yesterday I tried to argue that interesting facets of random graphs are the degree distributions, because these are the kind of things that we tend to measure in real-world networks. So how about the degree structure here? Percolation properties are always very interesting, certainly for a mathematical physicist, but also from an applied perspective. Somehow, can information flow through your network or not? That's described by the percolative properties of your network. And then also, how fast can things flow? And that's often governed by the graph distances within your graph. If I take two vertices that are extremely far away, will I be able to go quickly between them or not? Well, if we really believe in the 6 degrees of separation paradigm, at least on Earth, this says that we can actually hop very quickly between any pair of individuals, irrespective of where they are. Right? So the distances shouldn't grow too quickly with geometric distance. So if I want to connect to somebody in Eindhoven, where I live, I should be able to do that relatively quickly. But if I want to connect up to somebody in Greenland, I should still be able to do that fairly quickly. It might take a few more hops, but it's not going to take that many hops. Okay. So, of course, we've sort of taken an abstract view. Our graph is now infinite, and therefore we can study how graph distances behave if I let my points be far further and further away from each other. So that will be the game that we're playing. All right, a few pictures. We had a student who was doing a project on this. And this is an example of an inhomogeneous random graph. So it's the setting where we're on a complete graph. Every vertex has a vertex weight. And in this case, the vertex weights have a power law. And here the power law exponent is 1.95. So this is a setting where you have a high amount of variability between the degrees. And what you see is that this vertex here, it has a very big dot. The big dot indicates the weight. And the big dot comes together with a humongous degree. Yeah? And here we see a dot that is a little bit smaller, but still quite big, and also that one has a pretty high degree. Now if I look at the ones that are here, very small dot, very small weight, and this one only has degree 1, this one even has degree 0. Yeah? So just a mental picture for an inhomogeneous random graph. So that was the first model that we were trying to compare to. The second model is long-range percolation. So in long-range percolation, you have, of course, a diameter, which dimension, which turns out to be 2 here. We have this exponent that is in the edge probabilities, where the probability of seeing an edge between x and y decays like 1 over the distance to the power alpha. And in this case, alpha is 3.9. And then we actually have this extra percolation parameter, which in this case is 0.1. And what you see is that, okay, there are some long connections. Well, here you see pretty long connections, but they're not humongously long. And what you also see is that the degrees, well, I mean, some degrees may be somewhat biggish, but they're not terribly big, not nearly as big as here. So So this is an example of scale-free percolation, where you somehow combine these two. The dots here, the red dots, again, indicate the vertex weights. And you see that some vertex weights are pretty big. This is also quite a large graph. This is a two-dimensional case. Again, an alpha that is 3.9, a tau that is 1.95, which is quite small. That means that you have a high amount of variability, and you have weights that are extremely large. And what you see is that these vertices with extremely large weight also have an enormously high degree. So there is a clear relation between having high weights and having a high degree. Okay? And that's what we'll try to explore in the remainder of the talk. Is the model clear? All right. Now this is a picture in dimension one, where I think the height here indicates the weight, and then you can see, because you can map it in two dimensions, you can see very clearly which are the vertices with high weight and how many neighbors they have. All right. Let's go to some theorems for this model. So the first theorem is about the degrees. The first two theorems. So I was already mentioning that in long-range percolation there are settings where the degrees are infinity almost surely. That turns out to be the same here. There is one setting that is very alike long-range percolation, is if alpha is very small, then you're going to have infinite degree. But there is also a case where alpha is larger than d, but somehow the weights become so large that also there you have infinite degrees. And that turns out to be the case when a certain combination of many of the parameters in my model, namely the exponent alpha that describes the distance behavior, the exponent tau that describes the tail behavior, and the dimension d of my model, when this funny ratio is smaller than 1. Then actually, if I know that my weight is strictly positive, well, if my weight is 0, I'm not going to have any degree, so I have a better condition on the weight being positive. But if that is positive, I immediately have degree infinity. Okay. So in a percolation setting, this is not a very interesting case. So from now on, I will exclude this. Okay. So I will not assume that the degree is infinity. So now let's look at the case where the degrees are not infinity. And then it turns out that the degree distribution itself obeys a power law. And it's a power law in terms of an exponent that is, again, the same funny thing. And this is in the case where this exponent is strictly larger than 1 and alpha is larger than d. So the degree is now not infinity, as we can see, because then this probability would be 1 for every s. Now the probability the degree is larger than s falls off, but it falls off very slowly. It falls off like a power law, so it has scale-free behavior, and that's why we call this scale-free percolation. Yeah? Okay, so how does one prove this? Well, it turns out that this is not extremely difficult. So it's all related to somehow properties of heavy-tailed random variables. And there's a lot of knowledge that we have in the probability community about behavior of heavy-tailed random variables. So, for example, let's take alpha to be larger than d. The situation where alpha is less than or equal to d is identical to the long-range percolation setting, so that we already know. So that's not the interesting case. What I would like to look at is the setting where the degrees become infinity because of the inhomogeneity of the weights. So let's take alpha to be larger than d, and also gamma to be less than or equal to 1, then that is the setting where my theorem is saying that the degree should be infinity. That actually immediately implies, if alpha is larger than d, and this gamma is less than or equal to d, it means that tau minus 1 is somewhere in between 1 and 2, and that immediately implies that the weights have infinite mean. So if I look at the expected value of the weight, it will be plain infinity. Now, it's a heavy-tailed random variable whose mean is infinite. Then you can also look at how the mean blows up. So I look now not at the mean itself, but at the mean multiplied by the indicator that the random variable is less than or equal to some truncation value. Because the mean is infinity, I know that this will blow up as s tends to infinity. And you can compute very explicitly how this blows up. It blows up like a positive power of the truncation value. Okay? That's the main ingredient for this proof of the degrees being infinity. So what I'll do now is I'll condition on the weights being equal to little w. Now the nice thing is, and this is something that you should remember also in the future of the talk, so I have edge probabilities that are somewhat nasty. Why? Because they depend on randomness that actually is associated to both x and y. This actually means that if I look at two edges incident to a vertex, they're going to be highly dependent, because they're depending on the same w. But if I condition on the weight of this intermediate point to be some value, and actually conditionally they become completely independent. Because one edge depends on one wx, some other, and the other will depend on a wy somewhere else. And because all of these are IID, all these edges become independent again. So it's not true that the edges are independent, but the edges that are incident to a vertex, if I condition on the weight of that vertex, are independent. Well, then we can play our usual tricks. Okay? So because of that, if I condition on the weight to be equal to little w, the weight of the root, the weight of the origin to be little w, if I can compute the expected value of the random variable, which is the degree, the conditional distribution, if I can show that that is infinity, because all these indicators are independent, actually the thing will be infinity almost surely. So proving that it's equal to infinity almost surely reduces to the computation of an expectation, which is much easier. Okay, so let's look at this expectation. This is just the expected degree given W0 is equal to little w. What is that? Well, we actually know what the probability is that this edge is occupied. That's 1 minus e to the power minus w of 0, which happens to be little w, times wy, divided by, well, the spatial displacement between the starting point and the end point, which in this case is just y, to the power alpha. That's what it is. All right, well, that's not such a nice expectation, so I would like to simplify it a little bit. And what I'll do is I'll use this trivial inequality that 1 minus e to the power minus x is greater than or equal to x divided by 2, well, at least when x is less than or equal to 1. That's all that I'll need. And then I can just put this into this expectation. I get this expected value with this indicator. And that actually, if I remove the w and the y, is actually precisely of this form. I have a bit of a funny truncation value, y to the power alpha divided by little w, but okay, who cares? So I know that this how this behaves. So this will actually give me a y to the power alpha divided by little w to the power 2 minus tau. I stick that in, I start computing, and what I see is that I just get a power of y. The power of y is a bit funny, it's alpha times tau minus 1, and I was assuming that this is less than or equal to d. But if this exponent is less than or equal to d, then this sum is infinite. And we're done. So this proof is not very complicated. That's that's the main message that I'm trying to advocate here. Okay? That's it. All right. So what do we do when the degrees are actually not infinity? We want to prove that there is a power law for the degrees. Well, what we'll do is we'll do exactly the same. Because as soon as we condition on the weight, we actually get a sum of independent indicators, and we know very well how they behave. Okay, so I'm conditioning on little w. Well, now it's going to be more important what little w is, but we'll see that later. And we'll make use of one analytical fact about asymptotics of sums of this kind. If I take 1 minus e to the power minus a divided by a power of y, the power of y is larger than d, so this sum is finite. And now I'm going to see what happens when a becomes very big. Right, if a becomes very big, the sum will become bigger and bigger, but it will always be finite. So how does it grow with a? Well, it turns out to grow with a as a power of a, and the power is d divided by alpha. And you can sort of get a little bit of the feeling as to why this should be true by saying, how many y's are there for which a divided by y to the power alpha is of the order 1? Well, that's precisely this number. Okay? So this is very simple asymptotics. But it will be crucial in this proof. Okay, so again, I'm conditioning on little w, and somehow I'm trying to build in the back of my mind that if I want to have a big degree, I better have a very big weight. So I'm thinking about little w as being very big. Okay, so the expected value of d0 given that w0 is little w, well, that's a sum of 1 minus exponentials, well, with an extra expectation in front of it, and somehow put this asymptotics in it, and what you get is that as a function of little w, which is going to be very large, it becomes big as a positive power of w. And the power is precisely this power that we see here, d over alpha. There's a multiplicative factor that depends on the moments of w and the dimension and alpha and all sorts of things, but it becomes irrelevant. Okay? So it basically says that if you tell me what the weight of your vertex is, then I can tell you how it's, at least how its expected degree will, how big it will be. It will basically be a positive power of this little w. That's what this says here. Okay? But then conditionally on this event, this is again the sum of independent indicators, and we know that sums of independent indicators are very well approximated by their mean when this mean is very big. Okay? So that basically means that if I want to have d0 to be very big, I basically should have that the expected value of d0 is very big. And sticking that in, that is basically going to tell me that w0 has to be very big. How big does it have to be? Well, that's going to depend on this s by this inversion formula. But w has a parallel tail. So this is going to fall off like this to an inverse power of tau minus 1. And then we get this funny power here, alpha times tau minus 1 over d, but that was precisely what this gamma was. Wrong way around. That was precisely what this gamma was. All right. So we get that the degree distribution decays like a power law, and you can explicitly compute the power that belongs there, and that power turns out to be a simple function of the parameters that go into my model. The alpha that describes the long-range behavior, the tau that describes the tail behavior of my IID weights, and the dimension d in which we're living. That's it. Okay? So now if I look at this, I know precisely what the properties of such a random variable are. If you have a random variable that has a power law tail, if the exponent here is larger than 2, then you're going to have finite variance degrees. If it's larger than 1, then you're going to have finite mean. So if you're in between 1 and 2, then you will have finite mean, but infinite variance. So that will be the particular setting that we'll be quite interested in. That's a setting that you cannot have for long-range percolation. Finite mean, infinite variance degrees. Is this clear, even if the proof was not? All right. Good. So, the next thing that was on the agenda were the percolative properties of this model. So what is going to happen when I start fiddling with this lambda? You give me the weights, and now what we'll try to determine is for which value of lambda will there be an infinite component, and for which value of lambda will there not be. And of course, this raises all sorts of questions. This lambda is a continuous parameter. It can take all the values that are strictly positive. Okay? So it could be that you don't have a giant component ever. So that's lambda c is infinity. It could be that you immediately have one. That is lambda c is equal to 0. Or it could be that lambda c is strictly in between 0 and infinity. And all these cases are intrinsically possible. Okay? So again, I've written this over here already, but let's recall this. So I'm going to assume that we have this long-range parameter that is strictly larger than d, and this power law exponent for the degrees that is strictly larger than 1. So remember, if this is violated, then all the degrees will be infinity almost surely, and then certainly I will have a giant component, an infinite component. In fact, the infinite component will be everything. So that's not, in terms of percolation properties, that's not the interesting scenario to look at. So the percolation probability is the probability for this value of lambda that the component that contains the origin has size infinity, and the critical percolation value is the value of lambda c, for which this percolation function is becomes strictly positive afterwards. Okay. So this theorem actually describes in which dimensions this critical value is finite. Now we know in percolation theory dimension 1 is special. If you do nearest neighbor percolation for any p in dimension 1, you're not going to have a finite cluster, because somehow for nearest neighbor, if, as soon as you miss one edge, then you actually break the component up. And you're going to have an infinite number of missing edges, and therefore all the components will be finite. Right? And in long-range percolation, that's not so clear, because, you know, if you miss one edge, you could still have another edge that goes over top of it. But again, here, lambda c can be infinite under certain situations, depending on the precise parameters of the model. But let's forget about dimension 1. Dimension 1 is always very special in the percolation setting. Let's just think about the dimension being greater than or equal to 2. Well, if the dimension is greater than or equal to 2, then lambda c is always finite. Well, of course, except when the weight is equal to 0 with probability 1, because then lambda actually doesn't do anything, and you will never have any edges. Okay? So in all the non-trivial cases, lambda c will be finite. Apparently there is this critical value, that is a finite value, above which the clusters become infinite. So that's the finiteness of the critical value. The positivity is more interesting. So it turns out that sometimes this critical value is positive, and sometimes it's zero. And that again depends on this funny power law exponent. If this power law exponent is larger than 2, then the critical value will be strictly positive. But if the power law exponent is in between 1 and 2, then the critical value will be zero. That's sometimes called instantaneous percolation, sometimes called also called robustness of the phase transition. And it basically means that if I look at my model as a percolation model, if I switch on the lambda just a little bit, I'm immediately going to have an infinite component. It will be extremely thin, but it is going to be there. Immediately. That's a bit weird. That's a phase that we don't have in regular percolation models. Because there we always know that, for example, in the nearest neighbor model, you always know that PC is greater than or equal to 1 over 2D. It always has to be positive by branching process comparisons. That's not true here. And something similar is true for these inhomogeneous random graph models. Also there you can be in settings where the giant component is there immediately. And this is again called the robustness of the phase transition. So for example, in this Norris-Reitu model that I was describing before, also this has this property. So this is a property that is being inherited from the random graph settings. And somehow this inhomogeneity can be so strong that no matter how small the lambda is, these vertices with extremely high weights, they will somehow create a very thin web that will actually create a giant component, an infinite component. Immediately. Okay. All right. How many? I'm eight. Yeah. So let's not do this, and let's immediately go through to distances. That will be my last slide, because I wanted to keep a few minutes for some entertainment that is completely unrelated to the remainder of the talk. So bear with me for a little bit. So I wanted to say something about distances as well. I mean, we've seen yesterday that in these configuration models, there is a big difference depending on whether your degrees have infinite variance or finite variance. So when you have finite variance, distances tend to grow logarithmically. When you have infinite variance, they grow log-log of the size. Of course, in this case, this doesn't make much sense because the size is infinity. Right? Also, I mean, I was always taking two vertices uniformly at random. It's a bit difficult to choose two vertices uniformly at random from ZD. Okay? So instead what I do is I pick two vertices that are very far away, and I investigate what happens to the graph distance when these vertices become further and further away. And then what turns out to happen is, again, in this infinite variance setting, it turns out that these distances grow like a log-log of the distance. So if I take them to be very far away, then the distance is actually quite small. It does grow to infinity with when this distance tends to infinity, but very slowly. Right? So you might think that this is related to 6 degrees of separation. And actually, this turns out to be sharp in a sense, because if this parameter is larger than 2, so finite variance degrees, then this is not going to be the case, because then the distances grow at least logarithmically. And in fact, depending on the precise geometric setting, they might behave quite differently, like a positive power of x, or even linearly with x. That's sort of the worst it can be. Okay? So that's what I wanted to say here. These are a few of the references. Now something different. So, in Eindhoven, we've been quite interested in making networks accessible to a broader community. I think there are tons of people who find networks interesting. And not just our students, but let's say high school students. And how do you approach them? How do you get them to know about what is happening? What fascinating properties such networks have? Well, we've built a website for that. And this is called the Network Pages. Let me see whether this works. This is it. And the aim here really is to describe networks for a pretty broad audience. We've only recently launched this, sometime in December, so there's not a whole lot on it yet, but this is going to grow. And one of the things that we do is I have a postdoc who builds beautiful animations. So this is an animation of the configuration model of size 50 with a scale-free setting, and let's make this a little bigger, and let's make the power law exponent a little bit smaller. And now, how should I view this? Okay, so it draws this picture, and it also draws the, what is this? The distance distribution between them. It doesn't work out so well with the beamer. Somehow my picture is being blown up here. So this is the kind of things that we try to explain on a very basic level. And we also have some articles, for example, about congestion in networks. Also with simulations, you can see how the congestion builds up. And we also have a few items about the Erdős-Rényi random graph, again with simulations here. So this is a simulation of an Erdős-Rényi random graph of size 50 with edge probability 0.02. And then if you zoom over the vertices, you can see what their degrees are because they highlight. And again here, you can grow the graph. Yeah. This is a graph of size 100. And again, by going over these vertices, you can see what the precise degrees are. So vertex 28 has degree, 10 or something like that. So we're trying to make these things quite visual. And what I would like to do is to encourage anyone to just have a look at this website. But if you have something to tell to people, maybe high school level, bachelor level, or something like that, something that might spark interest, then let us know. Just drop us a line. That's it.
I had a question. With this log-log and distance
yep.
you get, can you say something about how you get there?
Yeah. You mean in this... give that back.
Back up a few slides.
Yeah.
Log-log is always an intriguing value. Right, yeah.
Oh, that's actually... So the funny thing is, in configuration models, we don't know how to get there because we don't have a sense of direction.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas here, if we're constructing the path, we actually know where we want to go, and that's actually pretty helpful in finding the path.
Right.
So we have a construction where you somehow you go to larger and larger domains in between the two vertices, mm-hmm. and you have to grow this in precisely the right way, somehow growing doubly exponentially, and therefore you get there in a log-log path. So it does give insight into not only why is it log-log, but also what does the short path look like.
That's what I was asking.
Yes.
Okay. Any questions? Maybe over here first.
Yeah, just curious. So like, if you take in the spatial aspect, if you take a Poisson point process or something like that,
So this has been done. I mean, we started on ZD because somehow percolation is my background, not stochastic geometry. But there have been people in stochastic geometry that have done precisely the same thing. And then you should bear in mind, you first put down a Poisson point process, then you add marks to the point process in an IAD way, and then you connect two points whenever some... Or either with a certain probability, or when sort of the product of the weight divided by the distance exceeds a threshold, or something like that. Yeah, that has been done, and you know, for all practical purposes, the behavior is the same.
Okay. Here is not closely related to what you talked about, but actually motivated by the applications you were discussing at the beginning.
Yep.
Here is a proposal for another type of random graph geometry, and I'm curious whether you or other people have considered it. So, I mean, think about a social network. I mean, like you said, there are various reasons why you might be friends with someone, and there are sort of different axes of it. So, I'm more likely to be friends with somebody who lives in my town, but I'm also more likely to be friends with someone who has similar interests. But somehow it shouldn't be that the distance is like a sum of these two.
Right.
It should be closer to a minimum. So, I mean, here's one very simple model. You could take a unit square or R2 or something, and you can run the points, but the distance is, say, the minimum of the X separation and the Y separation between the two points. So if you're in the same column, even if you're a long way away, you're pretty likely to be connected.
Yeah.
So is there any investigation of models like that?
No, it's a very natural question that you're posing. I believe that in this setting we're in a bit of trouble, because if you look at the minimum, there's going to be an infinity of number of people who have the same graph distance.
That's right. I mean,
and then, of course, everybody is going to have infinite degree. So you have to find a way to somehow reduce this.
Yeah, make it finite. I mean, I'm imagining in a column it's sort of like an training graph, sort of. But so it's, you know, it's another mixture of mean field and Euclidean. But it's,
I think this is very interesting. I'm pretty sure that you can use similar techniques once you've defined the model correctly. So if you were to look at the maximum, then I think basically nothing changes.
That's right, yeah.
But again, I mean, the maximum, I mean, from the application perspective, might not be the right way of looking at things. Yeah, that's a very good point.
So there's a range of parameters where you have different constants in front of your log log x, right?
Yes, that's right.
So is that because there's no probability one...
The simple reason is that our proof fails.
Okay.
But I do believe that there is a constant, but I just don't know which of the two it will be. So the funny thing is that one of these two constants is actually precisely the same thing as it is on the configuration model. That's the upper bound. Because it's 2 over the log of, the tail exponent minus 1, but here it's the tail exponent, and previously it was tau minus 2, but tau was the probability mass function exponent. So it's identical. That's very weird. There should not be any reason why this constant should be the same. But it could very well be that that is the right constant. If I would have to bet my life on choosing between any of the two, I would bet that one, not the other. But I don't have a way of proving this.
Let's thank the speaker again.